Do you want to know what it takes to be an entrepreneur in 2024? Talk On To Walk On is proud to introduce you to a podcast series in partnership with Baltic Ventures. Baltic Ventures is a Liverpool-based flagship tech business accelerator in which Patrick and I are angel investors. Regular listeners to our Talk On To Walk On podcast will know about both of our business backgrounds, ranging from working with large corporates to startups across multiple sectors. Based on our passion for business, we're calling this series Startup Stories. We're starting the series by showcasing a selection of the Baltic Ventures business founders, demonstrating why they were chosen out of over 200 applicants to join the very first Baltic Ventures 2023-24 cohort. As a result of their selection, they were each awarded 50,000 equity investment to turbocharge their business growth. Each founder guest has their own unique story with many businesses and life lessons to share. In these first three episodes, you'll be hearing from Dr. Sam Impey from Hexus, developers of technology allowing athletes to predict and personalize their nutritional needs. Kate Longworth from Gaia Learning, a global online school that supports neurodiverse children through personalized education. And Thomas Farquhar from Heatio, a clean tech startup that manages energy use in your home to cut your bills and carbon footprint.
Food has a massive impact on our body. Like, we literally are what we eat, right? That can actually help them to get fitter faster. You can get more out of the same training session by changing the food that you eat. From a perseverance perspective, like I have like moderate level dyslexia. I'm not too bad, but reading and writing, I was terrible. I really wasn't that great at school, which is ironic for someone with a PhD, I think.
So what we do at Gaia is we take online specialist education to the schools. And we say to the school, okay, so if you've got a child who is struggling in the classroom, and straight away the Senko or the head teacher goes, yep, I can name you 15% of my 950 school cohort. You know, what do you do when your child is at the school gate, physically clinging on to, and refusing to walk down that path of doom, as my poppy calls it, down towards reception?
We're actually trying to bring that, narrow that fuel poverty gap as much as possible. So that's why we're covering different parts of the journey. We want to take people on that journey. My first advice to a single founder would be go and get a co-founder. Go give away half the business to someone, because you're never going to have all the skills anyway. Horror show of having a bootstrap business, which is what it is. You know, it's terrifying because all, and it was the only thing we knew. We didn't realize that wasn't the only way you have a business.
These are seriously impressive and ambitious companies. So we are delighted to be sharing with you a conversational insight into the mindset of these entrepreneurs and how the power of conversation and community created at Baltic Ventures has boosted their growth by giving them the courage and confidence to walk on towards their dreams. If you love what you hear and want to learn more about becoming an investor or applying for the next Baltic Ventures cohort, go to balticventures.uk. If you want to learn more, or connect with any of the brilliant businesses featured in this series, all details are in the show notes. We're proud to be playing a small part in the journey of these fabulous founders. So let's talk on to walk on with Sam, Kate, and Tom in these first three episodes, and let's see where it leads. So welcome to Talk On To Walk On, Tom, Commercial Director of the fabulous Heatio, another incredible company that's part of the Baltic Ventures 2023 cohort. We'll just dive straight in. Tell us why you believe Heatio has got to where it is today and why you believe you stood out to us as a brilliant business to bring on to Baltic Ventures.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I've been looking forward to this. So why do I think we were picked by Baltic? I think I know it wasn't down to our pitch on the day, because I've had feedback that they'd seen better. But Simon and myself, we've never been in this world before of pitching and raising investment. So that's definitely a skill we didn't have when we started Baltic. But I think what they saw was we had big potential, and we've run a business before, so we know sort of the fundamentals at a basic level. So I think we had the raw materials and a bit of drive and gumption. I think that's what got us through. So
I love that answer because very much when, as investors, and I'm sure you've probably had this feedback as well, it tends to be people look at the people as opposed to the product. I'm certainly not dissing the product because we're about to come on to that and your offer, and Patrick's going to delve into that a bit more. But very much when you're looking at potential growth and potential, the excitement and passion around a product, you're very much looking at the person and whether we think, and I know that was what was agreed around the table, you have what it takes. You know, we've just opened the conversation just before the recording. You know, you very much indicated you're in the middle of a, you know, you're bidding, you're running a business, you know, that you've got probably a million things going on at once. And that takes real stamina, perseverance, adaptability, gumption, all those, you know, characteristics that are really important in an entrepreneur to, you know, hit that success button and keep going. Is there anything in that I've said that sort of hit a nerve? Is there something that you've learned in particular by being on the Baltic Ventures journey about yourself?
I mean, specifically Baltic's been incredible. Obviously, we came into it not really knowing where our gaps were, and, you know, potentially thinking we had some of them filled and then realizing that we didn't. So, you know, Baltic was a real eye-opener. And I think from what we've heard, it was, it's not the usual accelerator. It's a bit special. What we got from it isn't the norm. So we're very fortunate. And I think if we could do it all again, we'd do it in a heartbeat. But yeah, what we picked up from it, I mean, learning how to pitch was a big one. We've sold things to everyone from, you know, big corporates through to one man bands, but pitching is a little bit different. It's the same sort of context, but knowing what investors are looking for, what they want to hear, the sort of the acronyms, the expectation of pitch deck, that was one of the biggest learnings. And identifying where we need more support than we've needed previously, because to a certain extent, when you do a bootstrap business or a smaller business, you can sort of paper over the cracks a little bit. But with what we're doing now, which is quite big, those cracks would mean we wouldn't be able to get to where we need to get to. So they're probably the biggest things we picked up from it.
I love that.
And Tom, yeah, when you did pitch, what one of the things I remember is around the room, this realization or this sort of light bulb, let's say, going on, thinking, wow, this is a business that everybody needs to be aware of and everybody needs or certainly will need. So before we go any further, just for the listeners and the watchers of this, in terms of our research, I got lots of ways to describe what Hetio does, but best to hear from you if you can give us sort of the elevator pitch type description in simple language to describe what the business does and what it will be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a clean tech business. We set up Hetio with the main aim and sort of ambition was to bring clean, affordable energy to everyone, i.e. make it so that it wasn't just for the affluent or those that knew about it, because then we get real change. So what we're building is a home energy platform called Hetio Flex, and essentially we'll cover two parts of the journey from a consumer's point of view. For the vast majority of consumers, they don't know where to start or what to do when it comes to energy use. So you'll join the platform, we will take data from your home and show you exactly what's going on in your house, and then more importantly, what to do about it. Not, you know, switching lights on and off, but fitting different measures, insulation, glazing, all the way through to renewable technologies. But the most important thing is that consumers will have accurate information, i.e. if you do this, it's going to save you this. And we, you know, it's accurate, as opposed to someone coming around and doing a very finger in the air assessment. And then once you get towards the end of the journey, when we've got renewable tech in the home, so car charger, heat pumps, solar systems, that sort of thing, we're going to be managing and optimizing that tech, making sure it works to its best potential for the consumer. And we're also going to be doing flexibility for the national grid. So when the grid's struggling with too much supply or too much demand, we can address that through that tech in the home. So the way it'll look from a consumer's point of view is you'll say, my priorities are that I'm warm, I've got hot water, my car's charged, you do the rest. And we'll basically say, we'll give you all of those things, everything that you want at the times you want it, but you'll know at the end of the month, you couldn't have had a lower bill. You couldn't have had a lower carbon footprint. Everything was at its maximum potential. And there'll also be times a day where you get a notification saying, we've just charged your car or heated your hot water for free because it was excess power, or vice versa. We turned some demand down in your home. No impact on you. You didn't even know it happened. But here's a reward for letting us do it. So the home becomes this smart, flexy one, where the consumer gets everything they need and all this is sort of happening in the background.
That's great. And now I understand, because one of the ways you describe this is a home energy system with a virtual power plant. Yeah. And I understand that, because of course, the other thing is that you're transferring what sort of big industry has been doing in terms of its relationship with the national grid for a number of years into consumer, you know, residential power usage. This idea that when the grid is under stress, people effectively give up or give back power and vice versa. So it really is. I like the way, I think there's a misconception about sort of energy efficiency that people still think about, oh, it's when you switch your lights on and off, or it's when you put the washing machine on, or is my loft insulation? Yeah, those are all really important things. But what you're coming up with is a sort of much more holistic, overall big picture way of managing going forwards in the future your energy usage.
Yeah, and going forward, it's going to be one of the biggest drivers is flexibility and making homes work smarter in effect. I mean, there was a BBC article at Christmas that said that wind farms in the North Sea are actually being turned off, which is costing the average bill payer about £40 in the year because they've got nowhere to put the energy. So it's just as big a challenge as when everyone flicks the kettle on at the same time. The energy's got to go somewhere. And what's currently happening is you're getting, I'll call them entrepreneurs loosely, but you get entrepreneurs who are buying a container, filling it with batteries and dumping it in a field, connecting to the grid. And then when the grid's struggling, they discharge the battery. And when the grid's got excess power, they charge all the batteries. Well, that's not helping anybody. Whereas that was in a consumer's home and the consumer's seeing those benefits, you're actually encouraging them to transition. And then when they do transition, you're giving them extra benefits and bringing bills down ultimately. So that's what we're trying to do.
And one thing that might sort of initially scare off consumers is the potential. They think they've got to outlay a lot of money to get this to happen within their home. And I know you've got a solution for that. If you could just run through that and how you're going to help with the capital cost of, you know, because everybody's got a different, we've all got different homes, different needs. So how are you going to address that?
Yeah, so again, when we set this up, one of the biggest things we wanted to try and address was the capital cost barrier. Because for an average consumer, if you were going to put all the tech in a home, it could be anywhere between sort of £15,000 and £20,000. And that's either capital that people don't have or they don't want to put into this. They've got better things to spend it on. So what we've developed alongside a couple of partners is a subscription model where you'll basically, we remove the capital cost barrier and you take all the tech in the home on a subscription basis. So we're calling it sort of like the Netflix of low carbon, but it's actually closer to Sky, where you don't buy your Sky box, you pay to access your Sky channels. This would be essentially the same thing. We'd be saying we're going to put all these boxes in and panels on your roof. You're paying to access lower and more secure energy. So it basically opens up the entire market because you'd get a saving immediately. You wouldn't have had to outlay anything. You get all this tech managed and optimized. It's a bit of a game changer. So we are piloting that with government over the next 12 months alongside E.ON. And then at the end of that, the idea is nationwide rollout.
Exciting.
Excellent. And then tell us also about the green mortgage with Perenna, that deal.
Yeah, so because the platform that we're building lends itself to quite a few different applications, anyone from our point of view, anyone who's got a want or are being forced to decarbonize their customers is a route to market for us. So if John Lewis came out tomorrow and said, we want to encourage all our customers to decarbonize, we'd be knocking on the door saying, send them to our platform and we'll make it really easy and really clear how they do it. And we can then feedback all the information about what they're saving in terms of carbon and energy. Banks is another one of which Perenna are a big bank. So banks are now being pressured from government level to decarbonize their stock, i.e. your my home. So Perenna have launched a very innovative mortgage, which is very big in Europe. It's basically a long fixed term mortgage. It's 30 years. And over in Europe, people don't switch mortgages like we do. We spend a lot of our time switching energy suppliers and mortgages and all the stuff that in Europe, they're like, we don't have time for any of that. Mm. In Europe, you have one mortgage provider for life. You have one energy supplier for life because they know that within that mortgage, they can adjust the interest rate anyway. So that's what Perenna are doing. But there's a green angle to it where what they're saying is as part of your mortgage, you take it out. You then go on our platform. We'll tell you what to do in your home to what to fit in your home to save energy. Once you've done it, doesn't matter how you've paid for it, whether you've borrowed more or used cash or it doesn't matter. Once we tell Perenna that that you've made those improvements in terms of feeding the data back, they'll then give you a discount on the lifetime of your mortgage for basically going green, decarbonizing and becoming more energy secure. There's loads of benefits from their point of view. Not only the main one for them is they want to decarbonize homes because they need to, but ultimately you get a better value on your home. So you've got a better loan to value ratio. People have then got more disposable income because they're now saving on energy. So they're less likely to default. They're more likely to move and remortgage again. And ultimately you've got happier people as well because they've got lower energy, more disposable income, potentially they're warmer. There's quite a few wins on it.
Do you feel like an entrepreneur, Tom?
I don't, only because it's just it's a phrase that gets bandied around quite a lot. I feel more I'm tired.
that's probably the best definition.
I feel like we probably fit the technical definition, but it's one of those things you can't call yourself one. Other people probably have to call it you. So yeah, probably.
Because the reason I asked that is, you know, you are incredibly passionate. You are not just solving a small problem. You are disrupting, you know, with your solution. And you know, you've got years of experience in this. This isn't just something you've come up with jumping on a green bandwagon. You know, we'll come on to your history. But, you know, you are definitely disrupting what is a global problem, you know. So, you know, you need to give yourself some kudos and have a minute and give yourself a pat on the back, because even if one of these things that you're talking about, and I know you're juggling probably another million other things, pays off, the benefits to society are absolutely huge, huge.
And that's why we started it. We were seeing the analogy I use is it's like buying a pair of shoes. Those that have got the money buy a good pair of shoes, and that pair of shoes lasts for 10 years. You might need a resole, but essentially you keep the same pair of shoes. But those that can't afford an expensive pair of shoes buy cheaper shoes, which don't last, and they have to buy more or cheaper shoes. And in the long term, they actually end up spending more on shoes. So those that are those that don't have the capital are disadvantaged to a greater extent than those that do. And that's what we were seeing when it comes to energy. Those that could afford to decarbonize and switch to more efficient technologies, we're seeing all the benefits. And those that couldn't afford it, we're seeing higher and higher energy prices. Mm. So the disparity was getting bigger. Mm. So we're actually trying to narrow that fuel poverty gap as much as possible. So that's why we're covering different parts of the journey. We want to take people on that journey, try and remove the barriers along the way, but ultimately get people towards the end where they're nice and secure.
So coming on to your history, you've worked, you know, you've got your business. I know you've got lots of business partners, but the key one for us is Simon. And you guys have a history of working in this, in many, many years of working in this industry. And you've also had a business together in the past, haven't you? Which is still in existence. But did you exit? You exited from that.
Yeah.
And that was, from what I recall from my reading very briefly, was to do with solving the perennial problem of people having to comply with quality procedures.
Yeah, so essentially that was it. I turned up, Simon was one of my customers, and I turned up to him one day and he said, I've gone through this process, it's quite hard, but I know some other installers, I've offered to help them for a bit of beer money. And I said, that's awful, that website's terrible, that's an awful name. And I said, why don't we split it? I'll get the phone ringing, I'll take it out to people, and then And then once they take it, you do the delivery bit. And then within, I don't know, 3-4 months, I was getting phone calls off him going, "You've got to stop. I have my own job. I'm out," because he was out installing renewables, mainly heat pumps. He said, "I'm spending all my time dealing with people ringing up saying, I want to take your product. I want you to help me on the journey." He's like, I can't cope with this. And then 5 years later, we had 22 in the team. We exited to a business in Manchester. We helped them on their journey to become a very big installer. They've just exited that business into a big PLC. So yeah, it was a fun journey. But by the end of it, we had everyone from the likes of British Gas down to your one-man band using what essentially became software as a service. So we had different software tools, not just for the management and the record keeping, but also for designing the systems, sizing them, the customer journey. So it became a sort of a digital toolbox for installers. But yeah, it was different. It's fun.
What I wanted to come on to, Tom, was the fact you exited that business. What was your biggest learning? Because I know there was a bit of a gap between exiting the business and starting Heatio. What was your biggest learning? Did you take a break? Did you need some time for you? What did you get out of that?
Well, we spent quite a bit of time in the business that it became part of. There was a period in between where each of us did a couple of side projects, successful and unsuccessful. And then yeah, I think it was 20, just before or just after COVID had hit, beginning of 2021, that we got back together and we were actually still helping the business in Manchester. And then we left there beginning of 2022 to start Heatio. So we've always, Simon and I, people have started calling us the Ant and Dec of renewables. If that does take on, I'm definitely the funny one. but yeah, we're very, very good together because we have complementary strengths and weaknesses, all out, because we're quite, we just know how each other work. I don't know how else to describe it. It's like having a, you know, when you have one of those rally car drivers and there's the navigator next saying hard right, and you just trust them implicitly because otherwise you're going to crash and die. That's essentially, we've got that relationship. So when we put our heads together, we don't have to do any of that learning about how each other work. Whereas some of these founders I've met as part of this journey who have met for the first time with an idea, they're having to work out how to sync up and whether they even can. We've done all that. So
yeah, you've got really strong foundation in place to really go at this, haven't you? Which is fantastic.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that we, coming on to your question, what was the biggest learning? Having a bootstrap business compared to a startup that's going out and raising investment is completely different. And I think because we had that horror show of having a bootstrap business, which is what it is, you know, it's terrifying because it was the only thing we knew. We didn't realize that wasn't the only way you have a business. You know, we thought Tesco started like that and just kept getting bigger and bigger. But one thing that we learned was that fear and having to pay people and making sure you had enough money to pay them and you got paid last. And, you know, if you needed a balance sheet doing, you needed to be able to do one so you knew what the accountant was telling you was right. And we got all that foundation. That was the best thing we learned, was all that foundation, because now we've got that grounding, whereas a lot of the founders I meet are coming in going, "Got a great idea," and then they're chucked straight into this world of fundraising and glamour, and I'm a CEO of a team of two. And because we've had the war wounds and that I call it grounding is the best way, we've taken all that out of it. There's no ego, you know, this is just a different level now.
It's massively character building. I've been there with a business. We had business for 7 years, totally bootstrapped. And like you say, you know, we didn't know any different. We didn't know that you could go out. Again, I think it's, again, Patrick can come on to this. He's much more expertise in the world of investment than I am. But it's massively evolved over the last few years, I would say. It was just never on our radar, you know. But you say you've got the wounds, and it's, to prove that you've been there, seen it, done it, and you know now what it takes, because you do need a combination of both. I believe some businesses believe they can just go out and attract a shitload of money. and you know, have a couple of holidays, and then you know, work a keyboard on their keyboard and tap a few things and become a millionaire. Just doesn't work like that. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but you know what I mean.
No, definitely. I mean, when we first started, someone at the chief exec of the UK Business Angels Association said that your average angel investor has to invest in 16 businesses. That's their spread. Five of them die. I think it was six or seven of them become zombies, where they won't do anything and they won't die. And then you get two or three winners, but the two or three winners account for all the others. And I don't know how much of the zombies and the dies would be resolved if those people, and I'm not, they may well have done, had been through that bootstrap journey. Yeah. Because to immediately be thrust into, you've got an idea, you've never run a business before, and here's some money. You haven't. That's why angel investors potentially are having to invest in lots, because there's it's higher risk. Mm. Because you're putting your money into people that are potentially going to absolutely smash it, or potentially might not be able to execute. They might have an absolutely fantastic idea, but they might not have cut their cloth on some of the basics. And it's very, only from what I've seen, it's very difficult not to get carried away, because you're surrounded by people saying, you're a founder now, you're at all these events, and now you're CEO, and investors going, I'm going to cut you a check, bearing in mind they're also cutting 15 others, and you've got EIS, and you're on LinkedIn, and all these really cool things. But behind it all, you've still got to execute this thing. So I don't know if, I think that's one of the big benefits we've got, is we were constantly grounded by that. We do things differently. We definitely do things differently to how other founders are being told to do it. And that's just our way of doing it.
And Tom, it is interesting. If you look at the nine companies that are part of the 2023 cohort, they're all so different in their journey. And I can tell from Hetio, for example, that you have a certain amount of maturity in terms of your experience and where the business is. You've got your advisors on board. You've got your chief technology officer. You're the CCO. You've got that structure and that confidence. And you know, you're fundraising serious amounts of money, and you've had success and commitments to date. So at a snapshot, yeah, you can get a good picture as to where you are on that journey. But I wanted to ask about fundraising, because you alluded to it before we actually started recording this podcast. Fundraising is incredibly time consuming, and it's hard work. And how do you manage to do that alongside trying to run the business at the same time without it being too much of a distraction?
Red Bull for the first one. Definitely a lot of caffeine. I mean, I don't really know the answer. It's just intense. But unfortunately or fortunately, I do things slightly differently. So I don't really have gears. It's just full on. So we've probably done fundraising, or I've done fundraising far more intensively than some of the other founders. So because there's two of us, what in effect happens is I focus heavily on this while Simon sort of pulls all the strings of all the stuff I've had to drop. And then he comes into it to sort of assist towards the end. I think if we didn't have that relationship and I didn't have him, it would be very challenging. Like one of the biggest things I said a few months ago on LinkedIn is my first advice to a single founder would be go and get a co-founder. Go give away half the business to someone, because you're never going to have all the skills anyway. So if you've got a really good idea and you're technical, go get a co-founder that is amazing at sales and marketing. Boom, you've got it. But then you've got that balance that you can shift loads between you. So it's just, it's intense. It's definitely a big distraction. So my advice would be do it as hard as you physically can to get it done as quickly as you can. But also, once you've done first round, and it was another founder, it was Tessa Clark from Olio, the saving app for recycling and reusing food. She said you'll always be fundraising. So if you're constantly throughout the year talking to investors and having those conversations, so that when you then come to go, right, we're now fundraising, you've sort of been preempting it. You've been doing a lot of fluffing and preparing and keeping people warm, then it makes it easier. So yeah, it's unfortunately, it is a distraction. You just got to do it your way as quick as you can.
But I love the fact that you've just shattered some illusions there as well, because I think it's really important message to businesses that want to start up, scale and grow. You know, it is an integral part of the business. It has to be seen that way, and you have to allocate the time to do it. And obviously, while the business itself has got to be run. So that is absolutely brilliant advice, that, Tom. I love it. And because, again, I think there's a lot of illusion, as you've alluded to, that, you know, you get your title, you've got an idea, you're on LinkedIn, whatever, and you just suddenly, you think the world is your oyster, and yeah, not really appreciate the sheer hard work that's required. What is it that keeps you going, other than Red Bull?
I mean, it comes back to that question you asked earlier about would I call myself an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, it's an addiction. I think you've either got the addiction or you haven't. You can still have a business and it can be very successful, but I think there's certain people in certain businesses that are addicted. Take an Elon Musk for example. I would imagine he is very, very addicted. That's why he does some crazy stuff, because it's in his nature. That's part of it. You do it because that's what drives you. We've definitely got that. We're on a mission. We want to make some big impacts. That's what drives us in terms of this particular business. But outside of that, you can't switch it off, unfortunately. And we've tried. We've both been a part of other organizations where those entrepreneurial elements aren't required, and it doesn't work. It's not that you can't work for someone, but if you can't scratch that itch of being able to take something that doesn't exist, make a phone ring and make someone want what you've come up with, is like amazing. It's one way to describe it, because you're saying, well, I made that person want to have what I came up with. That's pretty special.
It sounds like your whole time is taken up with this. Do you switch off at all? And if so, how?
When at the moment, it's difficult to switch off. When I do, I like to try and run or at least work out. So, I got into running a few years ago. I decided I wanted to have a crack at a marathon. Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't say I enjoy running, but it definitely, once you finish and you get that runner's high, it's good. They compare it to like a serious drug hit, runner's high, because of the endorphin release when you stop, not when you're doing it. It's horrible. So running, bit of exercise. If I was on holiday, I'd try and read, but I'm not one of these people that can read motivational books. I'm trying to think of an example. These books that say, right, here's how you're going to, motivate a team and how you're going to get to that. So if I'm reading a book, it has to be a book that completely detracts from reality, not like sci-fi sort of thing, but like a thriller or something where I can just get lost and do that, or maybe the odd video game. But other than that, it's all about the kids. So I've got two boys, dad taxi most weekends.
How old are they?
5 and 2.
Fab. Hard work. Yes. More hard work.
So one thing it does do, though, is it completely solidifies the ability to get up early, because you don't have an option. So getting up, well, if anything, you can't sleep in once you've had kids, because your body clock completely changed. But yeah, they're fun.
And does Simon have kids as well?
Yeah, he's got a little one who's 6. He's only got one, so he's definitely got
so a slight... he has a certain understanding, but you can say that you have two. So it's double as much work.
We're both have that sort of family grounding behind it, but as I said, unfortunately, I'm one of these people that operates best at sort of like minimum level of operating. Like I can't operate at like 500 revs per minute. It's got to be like 5,000 or 6,000. So having 3 or 4 things at the same time means I get the best going. I can't sort of sit still.
Is there anyone that you actually, Talk On To Walk On are, that is based on and founded in the power of conversation, because that's something I'm incredibly passionate about. Having got hit at a certain point at midway in life and reflected on my life and looked back at when I've ran a business, when I've been through divorce, I've been through, you know, lots of things that happen to lots of people by the time you hit midlife. And I had a massive realization, like a lot of people did in lockdown, about me personally, how I didn't open up enough to people and ask for support, ask for help, that kind of thing. Are you guilty of that a little bit?
Yeah, massively.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think it's potentially an easy trait to get when you're in this sort of environment as well, that you've got very tunnel visioned, you've got to sort of lock in. You don't want to sort of show weakness or chinks, and you just plow on. But yeah, it is definitely something I'm working on.
That's good. I'm glad. I'm going to advocate that to you. That's your takeaway from me today. Definitely, you know, find that person. You know, you need to find different people for different things, but definitely have them in your toolkit. Tom.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of just on Baltic, by the way, the biggest thing, and I'd advocate for people joining Baltic, the other people on the program were the biggest benefit. Everything else, when I say, I'm not detracting from the other benefits we got, but the people who we met and who we got a lot of help from and we gave a lot of help to were amazing. We've got a call this afternoon where we're all catching up because we wanted to stay in touch. I speak to at least half the cohort on a daily, if not every other day, about how they're getting on, introducing them to people. They introduce people to me. So, yeah, we've made some really good friends there.
That's great.
It's a really special group, doesn't it, Patrick? Yeah. That's the message we're getting from all the other people we're interviewing.
I mean, the bar's been set pretty high now. I mean, yeah, you know, going out to Finland with them all, we got to know them really well. And yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to top that.
Yeah. And that's the sort of the power of conversation in reality, because you've had during the program your face-to-face meetings. And as you say, you're talking to them very, very regularly, and learning and sharing and all of that good stuff that you get from having a proper conversation as opposed to sending a quick WhatsApp or a text message.
Exactly. The first thing I did when you guys invited us on, I rang around the other ones and said, when are you going on? What are you guys talking about? And got all excited. But yeah, I mean, I can't do it enough justice how good that group was. And, you know, you've created something pretty special at Baltic.
Yeah, Heathio is in a great place. I think there's an awful lot. We probably won't go into it on this podcast, but there's an awful lot going on in government in terms of policy and announcements and so on, that I know you stay very close to, and you take your trips down to Westminster and so on. But if you were to think about the next, let's say, the next 12 months, and then looking forward in the sort of the next 1-2 years, where do you see Heathio going? What's your sort of vision for where Heathio might be in that period of time?
By the end of this year, we're going to have the first connected homes that we are optimizing and flexing, so proper customers. So in 2 or 3 years, we expect that to be into significant numbers, into hopefully 10,000 homes. So from an impact point of view, we want to have transitioned a large number of people away from fossil fuels, who are energy secure and benefiting, and brought as many people as we can out of fuel poverty, and along the way had some fun and created a really, really strong team to grow.
And where, last question, what would be your definition of success then in that period of time, 2 or 3 years? Is it those stats in terms of the numbers of connected homes, or is it something else in terms of where Heathio is in the marketplace and your reputation and so on?
For me, it would be a recognized consumer brand. The homes will come by default then, but we want to be seen as we don't need to sort of dominate the market. We just want to be recognized where, if you know, if you're a Heathio home sort of thing, you know, it's working to its full potential. So a recognized consumer brand by the average person in the street, that's dream success. If people know it without you having to tell them.
Are we going to finish with our quick fire? Are we going to do the Dragon's Den question?
Tom, Dragon's Den or Apprentice?
Apprentice every single time, but not the new one. The new one's rubbish.
Is it?
Is this what I'd prefer to watch?
Yeah.
I mean, now I know about fundraising. Dragon's Den's just bullshit. It's absolute rubbish. Whereas the apprentice in the old version, where you got a job at the end of it rather than just 250 grand, and they used to do more proper tasks. Oh, the apprentice was brilliant. Each day it was like, we're going to come up with something and then we're going to run around London trying to sell it to as many people. I was like, that looks amazing. It was like, you know, entrepreneur 101. Each time it was a different task around different skills of running a business. It was, yeah, apart from the odd idiot that went on, that was actually fun. But yeah, apprentice, when they used to do it and it didn't look fake and they were doing market trading and they'd set them up in whatever it was, Borough Market with a stall, and they had to see how many they could sell. That's brilliant. That's what I did at college. It was awesome. So yeah.
But you know, to balance it out a bit, I guess there are a lot of, I know Dragon's Den goes through a lot of pitches, but there are some famous examples of businesses which have received investment from the Dragons and have turned out to be highly successful because of, but may not be because of.
And also some that have become highly successful that didn't get investment, BrewDog being the obvious example. So, I just now knowing what fundraising's like, that is the only reason I would go on Dragon's Den now is for the publicity. I don't think they're anywhere. When Dragon's Den first came out and I was thinking, well, I'd want all five dragons because I'd want them all with their contact books and help. I don't know how much of that is real and how much of it is they have a team and they're quite detached. For me, it's sales and marketing, which is the apprentice. So.
Okay. So we asked the switching off question. We've done that already. So the other one is, which business leader inspires you?
Mine's a bit more to heart. So it'd be my granddad and my dad, who I would call them business leaders, but they're not, I wouldn't say they're an Alan Sugar. So that's where I got my entrepreneurial spirit. So my granddad had a menswear shop. It was 150 years old. So from the age of 12 or 13, I was working in there at weekends. And the best feeling of the day was when he walked in to come and sit in the office and I could, you know, take him a cup of tea and give me some pearls of wisdom. So yeah, that's where I got my my drive from. So yeah, that would be they'd be the people I'd call.
Oh, that's great story.
I love that. Is your granddad, is he still alive?
No. So he died when I was 17. I got asked the question. Someone else asked, they were like, who would your two people be that you'd have at your dinner if you could pick anyone famous dead or alive? And my two granddads. So yeah, they were pretty driving forces for me.
It's amazing how often mums and dads and granddads come up in these types of conversations as inspirational people.
Well, it's more for me, it's also more tangible because I could and with my dad I can pick up the phone, I can say this is what's happening, he can give me his take on it, even though he'd say I'm now well beyond where he got to. I'm bringing him up and talking about people we're meeting in London, he's like, this is crazy. But he's still the first person I'd ring, obviously other than Simon. But it's tangible.
Absolutely brilliant that you've got that. Is there anything in particular that either one of them have said to you that has stayed with you, you know, in those moments where it's really hard and you need to tell yourself something to keep going? Is there anything that you particularly remember?
There's two things I can remember now that you've raised it. One was initially my dad said, because he'd seen my granddad's business go through, 150 years old, so it had gone through, you know, the Wall Street crash, the recessions in the 80s, strikes, power cuts, and he said, always build to exit, because you'll run the risk of it failing at some point, but equally he basically said you don't get rich paying wages. You want to build it and exit it. So that was why Simon and I, when we had our last business, we said at some point the aim is we exit and then we go do it again. So that was the first thing. And then the main one was we had, I think in our last business, we had 1 month in the first, before we exited, 5 years, 1 month where we lost money. Because there was the government came in and pulled the rug out of one of the sectors and everybody got spooked. And I remember saying to my dad, I'm worried we're not going to be able to, you know, this is it. And we're not gonna be able to pay wages and we're gonna have to make everyone redundant. And, you know, it's Christmas and all the rest of it. And he just said, hang in there. You know, you, in terms of where you got to, it's just 1 month. It's not like, you know, you have to make these decisions now. It, you know, we weren't running out of money. It was more, is this it? Mm. He said, just hang fire and you know, you'll adapt and you'll deal with it. And then came back after Christmas, big announcement, you know, load of press around a new government program, which meant loads of installs getting into the market. And then we tripled in size. So,
incredible. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. And so without that conversation, you could have easily taken a big decision that could have gone in the opposite direction. Then you'd be head in your hands a month later going, what the hell have I done?
Yeah. I mean, that's where this bootstrapping war wounds came in, that we had those times where it's like, oh my God, the phones have just stopped ringing. Versus 3 months later, when I think we did 2,000 phone calls in a day with a team of 20. You know, we were talking to, I was talking to one of the guys from Octopus, and in their early days of selling renewables, they were doing what I did with a team of two, they were doing with a team of 45. So we, those sort of decisions and keeping grounded and just not panicking. But when you, I mean, we're very young. I think I was, when that point came, I was 23. So at 23, with all these mouths to feed, phones ringing, you know, rent and all the rest of it, a mortgage, that's why it's like you're reacting very quickly. It's like, oh my God, this is it. We've got to react, because you're in that bootstrapped world. Whereas this world is slightly different. And that's why it's good and it's bad, because it's dangerous, because you might make a different decision. Whereas you need that whole, right, do we need to react? Oh no, ground it, bring it back, make a sensible decision. Whereas if you've got 500 grand in the bank from investors, does your decision making change? And that's why a lot of the investors we have on board are like, we like this, because you guys know the sort of level beneath this, which grounds you for taking it up.
Brilliant. Yeah. I keep saying to everybody we're chatting to, the foundations are just there. It's like you're all on the cusp. It's like, it's so exciting.
Well, the one thing we've got, so I was talking to an investor the other day, and he said there's four things to a big successful business. It was like capital, idea, team, and timing. Timing was number one, and timing is the one you can't control. But the one thing we know from speaking to you guys and lots of other people is we are definitely at the right time. Mm. We know that what we're doing is timed to perfection, which is, as I say, is a bit you can't control. Just like Facebook, it was all about timing. All we've got to nail now is the execution. Which is still very difficult, but it's ours to not get right now.
And that execution is all about, and to pick up phrases that Michelle has used in the past, it's about this passion and perseverance. And you talked about the lows and you know, you being told to hang on in there. And when you're trying to execute and you are going through that phase, having that passion, that drive, but persevering as well are two qualities that we can see in you and Simon in spades.
Yeah. And I know I mentioned that my dad was the person that did it for me all those years ago. But yeah, that's definitely the balance Simon and I have, is I'll be redlining it and he'll be down here with the cautious head, and as in he'll drag me back. I drag him forward, he drags me back, and we meet in the middle. So yeah, we've got a good balance when it comes to that. Mm.
Excellent. Oh, Tom, can't thank you enough for your time today. It's been brilliant. Have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Hopefully, at the very least, it's taken your mind off things.
So as
we come to an end, unfortunately, you're going to have to put your fundraising hat back on and go back.
Well,
and
yeah, I've had 19 text messages, which is
Hopefully the conversations inspired you a little bit, because sometimes you do need that little break and reflect on your why, which is what we've just done, and it'll give you that energy to go at the rest of into the rest of Friday, and hopefully you'll get with some renewed energy, but pardon the pun, and then you'll have a little break with your boys at the weekend. Thank you, Tom. Have a great rest of the day. Take care. Bye.